Hey, how's it going? This is Chad Haig reporting from Southern India. I'd like to continue a series of videos on Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit by moving on today to Lecture 2 on Perception. This is a video for patrons only, and I'd like to begin by thanking everybody who has supported me on Patreon and joined the School of Forbidden Texts, the alternative to the front operation for the usury industry, which the university in the United States has become, a place where you pay an exorbitant amount of money to learn nothing. And we, of course, can do much better. And I'm so excited for this. And once again, thank you, everybody, for joining. So in Perception, you find the recurring theme in Hegel that what was a problem in the preceding section is adopted as your starting point in this one. So whereas the universal was itself the problem in the sense certainty section, because it's the opposite of the immediate, which sense certainty was searching for, in Perception we understand better because we just posit the universal itself as our starting point. Hegel says himself, immediate certainty does not make the truth its own because its truth is something universal, whereas certainty wants to deal with the this. Perception, on the other hand, takes what exists for it to be a universal. Universality, however, is also understood in a more sophisticated manner now, because we realize that the universal, which is grasped directly in intuition, is the property of a thing. The kind of universals we found earlier in scrutinizing sense certainty, such as colors, tastes, smells, those were actually properties instantiated in things rather than just raw sensations themselves. Okay. Yet whereas in the earlier section, these were just disconnected, contingent acts of apprehension, now we have a logically necessitated process because we can posit this experience as one of perception of properties of things. Hegel says himself, the object is in its essential nature the same as the process in this case. The latter is the unfolding and distinguishing of the elements involved. The object is these same elements taken and held together now as a single totality. Likewise, once again, we've evolved from the more primitive notion of sense data to the more sophisticated notion of a thing. The properly Hegelian irony is that you actually get sense certainty right only when you leave it behind for perception, he says himself. The object shows itself by so doing to be the thing with many properties. The wealth of sense knowledge therefore actually belongs to perception itself and not to immediate certainty, where all that wealth was merely something alongside and by the way. In other words, it missed the point of precisely what it was trying to accomplish, for it is only in perception that you have negation, distinction, and multiplicity in its very nature. This, in turn, can only be understood through a type of negation which is not merely abstract but determinate, as I refer you to the beginning of video one. He says, the this, then, is established as not this, or as superseded, and yet not nothing in an abstract way, but a determinate nothing. This is a nothing with a certain content. Likewise, to supersede, German term Aufheben, is at once to negate and to preserve. Once again, I'd refer you to the first video. Another change is that whereas in the last section I tried to avoid using language, language was the problem, now I can simply seize language and use it. With language and things, these two more sophisticated tools, if you will, at my disposal, for example, I can make statements like the following. This salt is white, cubical, and sharp tasting. However, this is not going to be quite the resolution that it seems to be. In fact, the title is itself, The Thing and Its Deception. Deception can creep up even here because that salt just might turn out to be sugar without contradicting the property through which I knew it. Either way, it's still cubical in shape, it's still white in color, it's still small in size. Those properties don't change, and yet I could still be deceived about what it is. We'll eventually find that if the concept is not the thing, as we thought, if the thing is to be preserved as truth, then there must be some sort of a problem within perception itself, and that's what we will talk about here. Still, we have something like a dialectic of perception, the way we had with dialectic of sense certainty. We posit the thing now as absolute truth for us. However, is that really free from contradiction? For example, how can it be one thing if it has many attributes? How can it be one thing if it's inevitably going to be related to many other things as well? And in this dialectic, you find, in the first stage, universality understood as the positivity of identity. This is simply positing A equals A as your formula. In this stage, each property is understood in self-relation. A color is a color. A shape is a shape. In the second stage, however, you have abstract negation. Each property is now negatively related to the others. I know what color is because color is not shape. I know what blue is because blue is not red, for example. And in the third stage, things relate to other things as such. This is something of a combination of the insights of one and two. You move from the self-contained and self-same one thing to a relational community of many things. And I will show you in this video how we get there. So in the first stage, you have a thing perceived in perception, which is understood to be a one, a self-same one for which any idea of otherness, insofar as you can even apprehend it, you only do so in a negative manner. And you have this understanding that otherness is something in the past. It has already been superseded precisely in order to arrive at this higher level of consciousness. That was a struggle which we kind of got over with in the last section, is the understanding. Hegel says, in the universality forming the principle here, the percipient is directly aware of otherness, but aware of it as null and not as what is superseded already. His criterion of truth is therefore self-sameness itself. And his procedure is that of apprehending what comes before him as self-same. However, the ancient paradox of the one and the many almost immediately returns. The medium, which is one, that is the thing, is only known insofar as a plurality of properties are known, each of which is itself a universal, which transcends the one itself. Hegel says, the object which I apprehend presents itself as purely one and single. Also, I am aware of the property in it, a property which is universal, thereby transcending the particularity of the object. The thing is just one, but it has a property, for example, the color blue. And that color blue transcends the singularity of the thing because it is not contained within its borders. It spills over into many blue things. You have a blue barn. There's also a blue sky. There's also the blue ocean water burying the city of Atlantis. There's a blue book. And the reality is, it's not just a plurality of different things containing the property blue. Rather, you're dealing with the universal itself. Okay. Hegel finds that the first form of being in which the objective reality has the sense of one was actually not its true being. Rather, the blue is itself a universal, rather than a property stuck in any one thing alone. This universal is, however, not really anything like the thing which we originally posited as the truth that we were searching for. Rather, this universal is one in which the oneness of the thing is negated inherently by the very same properties by which we knew it in the first place. And therefore, in this sort of second stage within this dialectic, you find an even bigger problem than this. The thing itself is not just one property. There's a blue soccer ball on the screen. However, it's not simply a color blue, it's also a shape, which is round. It's also a smell, which, you know, I can't exactly describe, but you know what it is. A smell of grass as it's been rolling on the ground. It has a taste, which I also won't describe for you. It has a size, a weight, a density, etc. On account of the universality of the property, I must rather take the objective entity as something of a community of properties. So although the thing is supposed to be a one, you find that the properties do not actually blend together harmoniously. The more you scrutinize the properties themselves, the more you find that each stands out. A shape is not a color. A color is not a shape. Neither one is a weight. Once again, the oneness of the thing has been negated precisely through the properties which are instantiations of the universals, which we posited as the very resource to understand this section at the beginning. Likewise, in the third subsection of this dialectic, you find that the thing itself actually just vanishes. We are left now only with properties as such, but ironically, we're left with a kind of property which basically returns us to the realm of sense certainty. That is, we tried to posit the unity of a thing, we ended up with the abstract immediacy of a color. Hegel says himself, it has left the attitude of perception entirely and gone back into itself. I am thrown back onto the beginning, and once more dragged into the same circuit that supersedes itself in every moment and as a whole. That is, we have failed to embody the notion of what perception of the universal, using the resources of language, whatever it was supposed to be. However, the repetition in dialectic is not entirely redundant. He warns us, consciousness then has to go over the cycle again, but not in the same way as on the first occasion. For in this way, consciousness becomes definitely aware of how its perceptual process is essentially constituted, that this is not a simple bare apprehension, but in its apprehension is at the same time reflected out of the true content back into itself. In the second stage we move on to, as a result of this, the thing is still posited as the true. Okay, we're still looking for a thing. But now the subject is emphasized in the second stage, just as we saw with the second stage of sense certainty. Hegel says, in this way we have now, in the case of perception, as happened in the case of sensuous certainty, the aspect of consciousness being forced back upon itself. There's something of a repetition that you find in thinkers like Hegel, but also Dante, in which Canto 6 of the Inferno repeats in Canto 6 of the Purgatory, and Canto 6 of Paradise, and yet it's not completely redundant. It's a very strange kind of repetition that you find. And in Hegel's case, the Phenomenology of Spirit as a whole book embodies this sort of repetition, which is not merely redundant. Here he says, the procedure of consciousness, which we have now to consider, is so constituted that it no longer merely perceives. It is also conscious of its reflection into itself, and keeps this apart from the simple apprehension proper. So it's a evolution, if you will, of the notion of perception, which now takes greater account of the role of subjective reflection. And what you find is that now we maintain the oneness of the thing which we were searching for by arguing that it comes to be divided up into its many different universal properties only by the subject himself or herself. It is white, but only for me. Hegel says, this thing then is, in point of fact, merely white to my eyes, tart to my tongue, cubical to my feeling, and so on. The entire diversity of these comes not from the thing, it comes from me. And he says, because the organs they affect are distinct on a subjective level, right? The eye is different from the tongue and so forth. These are subjective differences, rather than merely objective differences. Now we understand the medium, which before was the medium of a thing holding many properties but still being one. Now we understand that medium to be nothing more than our own subjective reflection on the many properties. Hegel says himself, putting these properties into a one belongs solely to consciousness. By the fact then that we regard the characteristic of being a universal medium as our reflection, we preserve and maintain the self as well. However, the question cannot help but arise, if it is merely white for me, how is it distinct in itself from other things? In other words, how can we be assured of the uniqueness of the one? And the answer to that, of course, is by its qualities, but once again we find our own position negated from within its own criteria, because white is only in opposition to black, and so on. The thing is a one, just by the fact that it is opposed to other things, as I quote Hegel himself. Therefore, in the third stage of this dialectic, you have now an understanding of what a thing is, because that's basically what's evolving here. A thing now is related to other things. He says himself, a thing is reflected into itself now, rather than simply this subjective reflection you had in the second one. It is for itself, but it is also for another. Properties are now revealed to be not the inherent parts of a self-same one whole, but rather the higher order structure of relation to other things. A blue square and a red circle can only be understood in relation to each other. You can't actually grasp what each of those is in isolation. Paradoxically, this means somehow I can only grasp the thing and its properties if I explicitly just go outside of it. That is, rather than simply say negatively that the one is not the other, I can only posit the higher order notion of a community of things related to other things if there's this strange sense of negation involved directly in there. This is why Hegel's dialectical stages are not positivity followed by negation that restores positivity. It's rather the reconciliation itself is with negativity, as Zizek repeatedly mentions. Yet this still negates the initial definition of the thing as the one which is self-contained, because this is not a world unto itself, after all. And if you look in a summary of these stages, stage one, we have this naive positivity that property is to be defined as A equals a property which seems to be indifferent to any other, a thing which seems to be self-related and indifferent to any other, a thing which seems to be a passive medium for properties to interpenetrate without conflict. In the second stage, the concept of being is revealed to be negative, insofar as being this means nothing more than not being another property. This level of abstract negation, which subjective reflection becomes the medium to hold these together, is followed by stage three, the combination of stages one and two. The thing is no longer a passive medium containing properties within it. Now the thing is realized as distinct precisely through its set of properties, yet its properties are not self-contained ones. They are understood relationally with others. No longer abstract. Now we have achieved a concrete understanding of this, but therefore the thing gets lost. It is itself, in a certain sense, just as the properties as such, and therefore there's an inversion where being for itself as non-essential is replaced with being for other as essential in itself. Property is therefore no longer purely thinkable, because insofar as it's attached to things, the German play on words for the conditioned, which just happens to be Bedingung, so Ding, Ding an sich is in German is the thing in itself. If it's conditioned, it's bethinged, okay? And in contrast, we now transition to the level of understanding as more sophisticated than perception. Understanding is a higher form of consciousness than either sense or your perception, because understanding is not the understanding of a thing with properties. If you really have understanding, it's the understanding of a force and its laws. This is the understanding of Isaac Newton and early modern physicists who understand, pun intended, that force is unbedingt and unconditioned universality. So we're moving beyond the limitations of a bethinged universality tied to a thing as a property, like the whiteness of that cube of salt. We are moving to unconditioned universality, which gives us, through the scientific notion of force, the synthetic unity of one and many in a more dialectically sophisticated level. I just finished with this quote by Hegel: "By this process, the object in its pure characteristics and those features which were to constitute its essential nature superseded, just as the object in its sensible mode of existence became transcended. From being sensible, it passed into being universal. But this universal, because derived from sense itself, is still essentially conditioned by it." It's bedingt. And hence, it's in general not genuine self-identical universality. That is, it's not the unconditioned universality of force. It's one affected with an opposition, which we will move beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. I look forward to the next.